Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Steve Karish reporting. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has announced plans for a broad international meeting on Syria during the coming week, stepping up diplomatic efforts to reach a political settlement of the prolonged and bloody conflict there. Kerry spoke to reporters in Vienna late Friday after meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Officials say the two senior officials were trying to find common ground between Washington and Moscow in their discussions about Syria's political future. After his talks in Vienna, Kerry will meet next in Amman with Jordanian officials and with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. Kerry and Lavrov also are meeting with representatives from Turkey and Saudi Arabia. South African students won a major victory Friday after more than a week of protests against university fee hikes earned them a meeting with the president. President Jacob Zuma announced after meeting with student leaders and academics that universities would not increase fees in the coming year.
On the matter at hand, we agreed that there will be a zero increase of university fees in 2016. Discussions will continue looking at broader issues than the fees.
But that meeting was not without turmoil as leaders talked behind closed doors in Pretoria. Police outside fired stun grenades and used water cannon after some student protesters tried to force their way into the premises. Student groups have said they will not halt protests until all of their demands are met. From Washington, this is VOA News. At least 18 people have been killed and 20 wounded in a suicide bombing at a mosque in Maiduguri, Nigeria, in a blast that occurred during morning prayers. This is the latest in a series of bomb attacks in the birthplace of the Boko Haram militant group. Rights group Amnesty International said this month that Boko Haram has killed more than 3,500 civilians so far in 2015. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton gave a forceful defense of her handling of the 2012 terrorist attacks on the U.S. mission in Benghazi, Libya, Thursday, in the face of tough questioning by Republicans. Clinton's appearance before the House Select Committee on the Benghazi attacks came at a key point in her campaign for the White House. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more.
Clinton was questioned for hours about the 2012 attacks in Benghazi that took the lives of four Americans, including her friend, Ambassador Chris Stevens.
You know, I would imagine I've thought more about what happened than all of you put together. I've lost more sleep than all of you put together. I have been racking my brain about what more could have been done or should have been done.
Republican Lynn Westmoreland said Clinton ignored previous threats to the U.S. mission in Benghazi.
It's not a matter if you knew about them. It's a matter of what you did about them. And to us, the answer to that is nothing.
We were certainly aware that the situation across Libya was becoming more dangerous and that there were particular concerns about eastern Libya.
Clinton said the requests for additional security never reached her and were handled by security experts. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Israel has lifted age restrictions on Muslim worshippers at a sensitive East Jerusalem holy site amid increased diplomatic efforts to end the violence between Israelis and Palestinians. This as Israel's military says a Palestinian was shot on Friday after stabbing an Israeli soldier. At least 42 people, mostly retirees, are believed to have died in a road accident near the French city of Bordeaux in what's being called the nation's worst traffic accident in three decades. Officials say a truck crashed into a bus, causing both vehicles to burst into flames. Hurricane Patricia is heading for landfall later Friday in southwestern Mexico. With maximum sustained winds near 325 kilometers per hour, the U.S. National Hurricane Center said Patricia is the strongest hurricane ever recorded in the eastern North Pacific Ocean. The Hurricane Center said Patricia is expected to bring rainfall of up to 50 centimeters in some areas. Mexican authorities have declared a state of emergency in dozens of municipalities. Reporting from Washington, I'm Steve Karish.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on African News Tonight.
It's the last day of campaigning in the Republic of Congo ahead of a referendum on proposed changes to the constitution. Some changes would allow President Denis Sassou Nguesso to stand for a third term. Another would abolish the death penalty. After violent protests against the referendum Tuesday, opposition activists say they are still trying, peacefully, to stop the vote taking place.
That's VOA's Nick Long reporting. Details coming up also in the news. Preparations continue for weekend elections in Tanzania and Ivory Coast. And there is another suicide bombing in northern Nigeria. And the UN Refugee Agency says some Syrian refugees are being abused. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour. It's the last day of campaigning in the Republic of Congo ahead of a referendum on proposed changes to the constitution. Some changes would allow President Denis Sassou Nguesso to stand for a third term. Another would abolish the death penalty. After violent protests against the referendum Tuesday, opposition activists say they are still trying peacefully to stop the vote taking place. For VOA, Nick Long has more.
The opposition says it's opposed to the government holding this referendum because it believes the voting will be rigged. Guy Romain Kinfusia is the spokesman for the opposition FROCAD IDC alliance. He says that for people to vote, there needs to be a credible electoral system, and that President Sassou Nguesso's system is based on fraud and corruption. After violent protests in Brazzaville on Tuesday ended with at least four deaths, the opposition called off plans to hold a rally Friday, but is still trying to prevent the poll from happening. Our message to the population, Kinfusia says, is one of civil disobedience, to stay away from town centres so that the referendum does not take place. He adds that the disobedience should be peaceful, but should prevent the administration from working. Government spokesman Thierry Mungala has warned against violent protests. He tells those calling for civil disobedience that that is their right, but they should keep within the law and not disturb the peace. Last week, French President François Hollande said constitutional changes in Congo-Brazzaville should be achieved by consensus. In response, Mungala commented that there isn't a political consensus on the proposed constitutional changes, so the people must decide. This week, Mungala welcomed a statement by Hollande that President Sassou Nguesso has the right to consult his people and they must reply. The Paris-based International Federation for Human Rights, FIDH, questions the legitimacy of holding the vote. The African Union Charter on Democracy is relatively clear, says FIDH researcher Cherina Gerolon, that constitutional amendments aimed at preventing democratic changes of power should be avoided. Under President Sassou Nguesso's 32-year rule, the country has recovered from civil war and seen sustained economic growth. Analysts told VOA that few observers expect him to lose the vote Sunday, but the opposition is more united than in the past, and a yes vote could provoke further protests. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
Tanzanians go to the polls Sunday for general elections, including the selection of a new president. But unlike in past years, the opposition appears strong this time around and could present a challenge to the country's longtime ruling CCM party. From Dar es Salaam, Jill Craig has more.
Here in Dar es Salaam, election season is in full swing. Posters cover walls and billboards, flags fly the colors of the two main parties, and many people are dressed in distinct colors. Green and yellow for ruling party CCM, red, white, and blue for Chadema, the opposition. Otieno Ogogo is dressed in green and yellow. He says he will be voting for CCM's presidential candidate, former Minister of Works John Magufuli, because CCM has done a good job in recent years.
Look at the peace around us. In many countries, not like that during election period. You would have seen people walking around freely, doing shopping freely, and at the same time, not only that, look at the development in our city of Dar es Salaam.
But Chadema's supporter and retired banker, Analia Bondi, disagrees. She says she is particularly frustrated by the educational system and will be voting for former Prime Minister Edward Lowassa, Chadema's presidential candidate, because she thinks he will make improvements.
Well, I think we need a change. I think the ruling party has been in power for so long and is moving very slowly in terms of development. So I think Chadema is the party to bring change.
The perception of CCM as moving slowly has been a challenge during the campaign, says CCM National Executive Committee member January Makamba. But he argues that Tanzania has seen much progress in the past 10 years.
Some of the young people who complain the most about our party are the ones who have done the best in their lives over the past 10 years. You know, once you are in power for such a long time, sometimes people come to a point where they seek change just for the sake of it. But what we have done is we have picked a candidate who counterbalances that notion of a tired, old, corrupt party.
Moisiga Baregu, a member of Chadema's Central Committee, says that CCM already had its chance.
What they are saying and what the candidate is saying is that give us another chance, we'll try better next time. And I'm sure. And what we are saying is that 50 years plus is a long time, and that probably Tanzanians deserve better.
Benson Bana is a co-chairman of CMONT, the Coalition on Election Monitoring and Observation in Tanzania. He says his organization has deployed 350 observers in all parts of the country who are watching to see if the electoral process is credible, free, and fair. So far, so good, he says.
The election management bodies, it seems this time, they are well positioned to deliver an election that's going to be credible to the Tanzanian people.
Unlike his counterparts in Burundi and other African countries, President Jakaya Kikwete chose not to seek a third term this year. That may have lowered tension and set the stage for what looks like will be a peaceful vote. Jill Craig, VOA News, Dar es Salaam.
This Sunday, elections in Tanzania pit the long-ruling Chama Chama Mapinduzi Party against the opposition Civic United Front. The opposition is said to be the strongest in cities, even though the ruling party candidate is credited in part for the new rapid transport bus system in Dar es Salaam. VOA's Vincent McCourty is in Tanzania following the polls. He says much of the media is covering the enthusiasm attributed to the opposition and the desire by the voters for change. But in a conversation with reporter William Eagle, Vincent also says the long-ruling CCM party still has plenty of support, especially in the rural areas and among older people.
You know, there's no denying the fact that there has been development in the country over some years. The ruling party is the party that, for most people, is responsible for where the country is today. It is not a pathetically poor, miserable country. No, it is a developing country. In fact, economists will tell you that it's growing at the pace of about 7%, which is fairly high anywhere in the world. Many people will credit the ruling party with, you know, whatever has been done up to this point in security, in infrastructure. But for those who are in the opposition and majority, the younger people, they feel that Tanzania could have been far ahead of where it is. The infrastructure development could have well been much better developed than it is today. So it's a question of how somebody judges this party. For those who think Tanzania could have done way better than this, they want change. They want somebody else who they believe could do a better job. They do believe that the ruling party has had so much corruption within the system, and many people have gotten away with corruption. Those in the government or those who believe in the ruling party say, well, they have done quite a bit, and we believe that they can do perhaps a much better job under the current leadership, who they see as bringing kind of fresh kind of air, fresh blood, bringing some fresh blood into the party system, and hopefully because of some of the things he claims he has done, including perhaps being behind the introduction of this rapid transport system, and perhaps it could be a new dawn for the ruling party.
Observers say that the ruling party is particularly strong among older people and rural areas. Have you been to rural areas to speak to people? Is the government delivering there the services they need? Have you spoken to older people who, once again, may have some sort of attachment to the founding fathers, to Julius Nyerere, a sort of patriotism to the ruling party that perhaps young people don't have?
I mean, that is the thing. For the older generation, there is that affinity with the old, Julius Nyerere. They literally believe in him almost like a religious leader. For them, the CCM party, the ruling party, is the party of Julius Nyerere. They connect with him, they kind of relate with him. And so for them, this is the party of this country. The opposition is unknown. The opposition for them sometimes looks like it's confused because they don't really understand it as well. For the younger, more modern fellows, they just want an alternative. And they resonate more with the opposition parties because the opposition parties are made up of more, you know, some younger, radical-minded kind of people. And so that is where you see the divide. The older generation are very, very much in favor of the ruling party. Women, for some reason, also feel more comfortable in the ruling party. More of the younger generation, men, mostly younger men, are more in favor of the opposition. Note that there is a major difference in policy. I think it is more of a change. The younger generation just want to see change. They do not connect at all with the CCM, the ruling party, because they see it as an old, outdated party that has been around for just too long. They want to see something different.
That was VOA reporter Vincent McCory in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. He was speaking with reporter William Eagle. The electoral campaign for Sunday's presidential election in Ivory Coast enters the home stretch. More than 6 million people are expected to go to the polls this Sunday to elect the president. Incumbent Alassane Ouattara is running for a second term and will face 7 other candidates. Emilia Ayoub reports from Abidjan.
Echoing from the street of Ganioa, this campaign song lists all the promises that current Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara says he will implement if he wins the upcoming election. The sound comes from the local headquarters of his party, a building several stories high with campaign posters plastered across it. Here, local campaign director André Logbo says the campaign is doing just fine. He says that, for now, everything is doing well. The campaign team have not been insulted, not even when they were campaigning in villages, Logbo says. Maybe people have come to understand the principle of a democratic election. There were reason to worry about clashes. Ganioa is the stronghold and native region of former President Laurent Gbagbo. During the last election in 2010, Gbagbo backers and Ouattara supporters fought for months after both candidates claimed victory. Eventually, Gbagbo was arrested and Ouattara became president. Gbagbo is now awaiting trial before the International Criminal Court, but simmering tensions remain in his native area. Last month, opposition supporters protested against Ouattara's candidacy, saying it is unconstitutional. Intercommunity clashes afterward left 2 people dead. A couple of weeks later, Ouattara came for a visit and called on people to reconcile. Traditional chief Joseph Gadji Dagbo echoed that call and asked the president to forgive the Ganioa people, stating that compromise is the only way to reconciliation.
Le groupe qui a gagné et un groupe qui a perdu.
The chief says one group won and another group lost, but no one should remain mired in this squabble that keeps people in jail. So we ask for forgiveness, he says. And we asked so well that, for the first time, Ouattara also admitted his responsibility in the conflict and also asked for forgiveness. But here in Ganioa, some Gbagbo supporters claim there cannot be any reconciliation unless Gbagbo old allies are allowed back in the streets. This is Leandre Gwika Diokri, interim local secretary of the FPI, Gbagbo's former party. There has never been a beginning of reconciliation in Ivory Coast, he says, because the two warring parties have never really been brought to the same table. Gika says there are still a lot of people in jail or in exile. So if one wants free and peaceful and transparent elections, everybody should be allowed back. The party official says the list of voters is also full of mistakes and should be reviewed. He adds that Gbagbo supporters feel sidelined and angry. Frustration feeds rebellion, Gika says. And today, the youth feel unjustifiably left out of the elections. That can trigger reactions that we cannot control, he says. Gika does not support Pascal Affien-Guesson, who claims to be the official candidate of the FPI. The party split into two factions recently, between Afi supporters and pro-Gbagbo hardliners who demand the former president's release. If nothing changes, Gika says Gbagbo supporters should boycott the vote. Emilia Hop for VOA News in Ganioa, Ivory Coast.
Officials in northern Cameroon say soldiers clashed with Boko Haram insurgents after the militants attacked a remote village today and slit the throats of at least seven residents. The raid occurred in Kirawa, a village in the far northern region. Across the Nigerian border in the city of Maiduguri, at least 18 people have been killed in a suicide bombing at a mosque. About 20 others were wounded in the blast during morning prayers. The twin blasts went off at the mosque in the city of Jedari, Polo area. This is the latest of a series of bomb attacks in the Borno state capital, birthplace of the Boko Haram militant group. A week ago, at least three suicide bombers blew themselves up on the outskirts of Maiduguri, killing at least four people. The multiple blasts occurred just hours after two suicide attacks inside a mosque in the capital where 37 people died. The UN Refugee Agency reports refugee women and children on the move in Europe, many of them fleeing war and persecution in Syria, are subject to violence and abuse, including sexual exploitation. Lisa Schlein in Geneva reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says it is alarmed by the increasing number of credible testimonies of abuse it is receiving from refugee and migrant women and children who have arrived in Europe. It says women and children comprise 34% of the 664,000 people who have made the perilous journey across the Mediterranean Sea to Europe. UNHCR spokeswoman Melissa Fleming says refugee and migrant children on the move are at particular risk of violence and abuse in overcrowded reception sites as well as in parks, bus and train stations.
We have heard very, very disturbing testimonies that indicate there are incidences of children having to engage in survival sex to pay the smugglers to continue their journey, either because they've run out of money or because they have been robbed.
Fleming says smugglers are not the only criminals. She says other refugees and migrants also commit these heinous acts. But she says most of the exploitation of women and children is done by criminal gangs. She says unaccompanied children are particularly vulnerable as they lack the protection and care of an adult. She says the UNHCR also warns against putting children in detention. She tells VOA, countries throughout Europe, including Greece, are putting children in detention facilities, sometimes with other adults. She says children packed into these prison-like settings are at great risk of abuse and exploitation.
What we're talking about are groups of traumatized children who fled, in many cases, war or who have just embarked on journeys that are nightmarish. And to subject children to detention is inhumane.
The UNHCR is calling on European governments to ensure the protection of women and children, including through the provision of adequate and safe reception facilities as they move along in search of asylum. The agency also is urging national authorities to find safe alternatives to the detention of children. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Police are calling yesterday's killing of two people at a school in southern Sweden a hate crime. Officials in the industrial town of Trol Yatan have discovered evidence in the apartment of the 21-year-old assailant that he was motivated by racism and the influence of Nazi literature. Sweden is a major EU destination for migrants from Africa and the Middle East. The school's student population is predominantly foreign-born. The killer entered Kronan school yesterday, dressed in a black mask and cape and brandishing a sword. Students initially thought he was a student dressed for Halloween. The suspect was shot and killed by police responding to the incident. His identity has not been revealed, but he apparently did not attend the school. Last night, Sweden's prime minister called the tragedy a black day for Sweden. The country expects about 109,000 newcomers by the end of 2015. Meanwhile, since Hungary closed its borders a week ago, Croatia has let more than 47,000 migrants pass through their country into Slovenia. In Paris, authorities are moving hundreds of Syrian and Afghan refugees out of an abandoned high school in the northern suburbs. They are being relocated in shelters in the city. The refugees had moved into the empty Jean Coiré school during the summer, but officials recently declared the school a health hazard. Lebanon's Navy has stopped two boats of Palestinian and Lebanese migrants on the Mediterranean. The nation hosts more than 1 million refugees. A quarter of Lebanese citizens live below the poverty line, and youth unemployment is high in the nation. A two-day summit opens Monday in Geneva that will consider the long-term effects of migration in cities. The International Organization for Migration says in the coming years, migrants will become a major percentage of urban populations. VOA's Jody Kepawa reports.
The IOM says the high-level conference on migrants and cities will assess how challenges can be managed and development opportunities maximized. Azuz Samri is the head of the organization's governing bodies division. He says a major population shift will occur over the next 35 years.
By 2015 now, almost 6.4 billion of world population will be living in cities, which means that's a huge number. Currently, most of the world population is living in cities. And this implies that there will be a lot of human mobility toward cities.
Samri says local authorities often have ignored the issue of human mobility or migration and its effects on their cities. The IOM states that while mayors are at the forefront of migration governance, their voice has been missing from the global debate.
The debate is not complete, because one of the main actors when it comes to service providing are local authorities, and mayors were not involved and were not included in the debate. So we said this is a right time to give them opportunity to discuss on how they have a stronger voice in policy discussion when it comes to migration and human mobility.
At the high-level conference on migrants and cities, the IOM will launch the World Migration Report for 2015. The theme is new partnerships to manage urban mobility.
We want actually the debate about urbanization to include this human dimension. Actually, the World Migration Report will bring to the light the challenges that cities will be called to face when it comes to managing the population and migrant in particular.
Migrant issues include integration, urban planning, vulnerable migrants, and diaspora's role in promoting urban development. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suwuhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
When When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America, and here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Preparations continue for weekend elections in Tanzania and Ivory Coast. There is another suicide bombing in northern Nigeria. And the UN Refugee Agency says some Syrian refugees are being abused. Coming up, music from Ghana. And in our feature segment, an award-winning film on child marriage in Ethiopia. I'm Yehi Suhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Hello, Sunny.
Happy Friday, Yehi.
Sunny, I understand your starting line is international athletics.
This
is a busy time of year in the world of marathon running, and athletes from Kenya and Ethiopia are once again leading the way. Earlier this month, the Kenyans Dixon Chumba and Florence Kiplagat won the men's and women's titles at the Chicago Marathon here in the USA. Chicago is one of the six world marathon majors, along with Boston, New York, London, Berlin, and the Tokyo Marathons. Look for the Kenyans and the Ethiopians to challenge for titles at the New York City Marathon on November 1st. Meanwhile, some speedy Africans will also be on the starting line of Sunday's Frankfurt Marathon in Germany. The energetic Andy Edwards caught up with a top Kenyan athlete ahead of the race. Here's Andy.
We're talking with one of the top African runners in the Frankfurt Marathon on Sunday. That's Mika Kogo, who has quite a lot of claim to fame. He's been a world record holder at 10 kilometres on the road, been very good track runner as well, and now he's very much a marathon runner, and his best goes back 2 years ago when he finished fourth in Chicago in 2:06:57. Now, he's had a busy year, and Mika, I think it would be fair to say that since Chicago, I mean, you haven't got that close to 2:06. You ran Hamburg this year, ran 2:10, which is a good time. But have you got something to prove on Sunday? You know, whether now coming to your sixth marathon, whether you really are a marathon runner?
Thanks so much for being invited to compete in Frankfurt Marathon. Coming to Frankfurt Marathon is my chance of getting back where I should be, because for the last four or three marathons which I have ran, some I did a little bit down, but every time sport you have to win, you have to lose. But for me, coming for today, I see my preparation was well, and I've seen my training partners like Mark Tor, Mike Egan, doing well in some their own races, because the market tour started with Andofen, which he finished on that position, and Mike Egan also finished last week in that position. So those are my training partners and many of others, but if I catch myself, I am hoping to try my best.
Of course, another of your training partners, at least occasional training partners, is Mo Farah, and you finished second to him in Lisbon in the half marathon earlier this year, in the build-up to the Hamburg Marathon. Is it something, in a sense, in your head that you've had success at the shorter distances and you're still adjusting to the marathon? Because we're chatting before the race, of course, and you're saying you really like a fast pace. You don't like, quote, jogging. Well, of course, your jogging is very fast running for most people, but you really would like, and the organisers are talking about, a fast pace all the way through to 30 kilometres. Have you thought about the reasons for not quite achieving your potential yet?
Yeah. especially last season when I was coming to Hamburg Marathon. I did half marathon. I did my training as usual, starting with the gym, build up long runs, speed walk, putting everything in my body, like my leg speed walk. And I was ready when I was coming to Hamburg. Before I did, I went to Lisbon to try myself to see if I have some speed. And then I went to Lisbon, I see the body was responding well. And when I was coming to Hamburg, I was having some percentage that I could do my best. I could try to improve even my personal best, which is 2:06.57. But the problem was I had, when we started the race, I had a problem with the shoes. My lace of the shoes keep me a tough time during the race.
I see. Well, yeah, you're not the only Kenyan recently. Last month or so has had a problem with shoes. I think Eliud Kipchoge could say a few words about that in Berlin. Well, of course, talking of Berlin, you were down to run there, but you had some injury problems. So are you all fit and ready for Frankfurt? The injuries that stopped you running Berlin, are they now cleared up?
I've never had any injuries or any problem, but I am really happy to be in Frankfurt and hoping to see if everything will go well, no problem, no anything to disturb me on during the race. So just in my focus to do well in Frankfurt Marathon.
Well, it's certainly a fast course. It's been shown that in the past. And you're a fast man, Mika Kogo. Wish you all the best for the 34th edition of the Frankfurt Marathon this Sunday. Thanks, Mika.
Thanks so much.
Africa. Dr. Larry Zamoja here, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM. Keep getting sporty sunshine with Sunny Young. We all do at Sports Radio 88.9 Brilla FM, broadcasting out of the cities of Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha in Nigeria, as well as the World Wide Web on www.brillafm.net. I tell you this. It's always a thrill, yes, a thrill, to remain on the sunny side on Brilla with Sunny. Keep listening, Africa.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Football news now on the Voice of America. The Spanish giant Barcelona is providing a boost to Rwanda, as we hear now from our African football guru, David Legg.
Barcelona in December are going to launch an academy in Kigali. It's going to cost $10 million. This is a tremendous boost, surely, not only for Rwanda, but for East and Central African football in general. And it's a region that needs a boost. We have yet to see an East African country qualify for the World Cup. And sadly, very few East and Central African countries are making it to the Africa Cup of Nations. So this is a tremendous boost. And this is the sort of academy that's produced players like Andres Iniesta, Puyol, Busquets, and the one and only Lionel Messi. If I quote Luis Garcia, a former Liverpool and Barcelona star, he says, "The only way to develop football in Rwanda and Africa at large is for people in the football sector to start working like we do in Spain on tactical, physical, and psychological concepts." There's also talk of a similar academy coming in Uganda. I salute not only Barcelona for their venture, but also the Rwandans, who seem to be very, very keen on developing their football. Recently, in the Africa Cup of Nations, the Wasps, as the Rwandan national team are known, they did very well against Ghana. They held the Black Stars for 87 minutes in the Amahoro Stadium before losing 1-0. And I would certainly consider Rwanda to be one of the most progressive football nations in Africa. They've already hosted the African Junior Championship. That's for the under-17 footballers. They've also hosted the African Youth Championship for under-20. And come January and February, they're going to host the CHAN competition. That's the African Nations Championship for home-based stars. My prediction is one of these days, Rwanda will host the Africa Cup of Nations, the premier competition on the continent. They're a very well-organized football federation. They've also got what must be one of the youngest national coaches in the world, in 29-year-old Johnny McKinstry from Northern Ireland. If you look at their Cup of Nations, they went to Mozambique, never an easy place to come away from, with 3 points, and they won 1-0. And as already mentioned, they put up a very good fight against the Black Stars of Ghana. Now, I don't see the Rwandans winning their Cup of Nations group. I think that is going to be Ghana. But there are two places at stake for the best runners-up for the 2017 tournament. And again, I'm sticking my neck out here, I know, but I'm saying that Rwanda are going to fill one of those two best runners-up positions.
Keep sticking your neck out, David. We enjoy your soccer-licious predictions. That's our African football guru, David Legg, sticking his neck out and speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. If you go to my Facebook page, you'll see an up-close and personal photo of Edson Arantes do Nascimento, better known as Pelé, the Brazilian football great. The man many call the greatest player of all time is celebrating his 75th birthday on this Friday. Happy birthday, Pelé. We heard David Legg mention Barcelona star Lionel Messi earlier. I think Messi and Real Madrid's Cristiano Ronaldo are generally regarded as the greatest players of the past decade or so. But facts are facts, VOA football fans. Neither Messi nor Ronaldo has lifted the World Cup trophy. Pelé did it an unprecedented three times: 1958, 1962, and 1970. Finally, in rugby, the Springboks of South Africa are two victories away from lifting the Rugby World Cup trophy for an unprecedented third time, but they face a huge test on Saturday, the defending champion All Blacks of New Zealand at Twickenham Stadium in London. Like the Springboks, the All Blacks have won two Rugby World Cups, and they're coming off a 62-13 rout of France in the quarterfinals. In the second semifinal on Sunday, also at Twickenham, Argentina will play Australia, another two-time world champion in rugby. Lots of excitement, rugby excitement at Twickenham. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Have a good weekend, everyone. Back to Yahias Wuhee.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 UTC, right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, an award-winning film on child marriage in Ethiopia. And next, questioning freedom of expression in Egypt. But first, some music. Here is Mr. Oduri of Ghana with Abiba.
Mayada, macheke. Mayada, macheke. Mayada, macheke. Mayada,
Abiba.
Mayada.
Abiba, NDC law, Yenya Clinton near the Yako High Court, President Sekola at 2C saw, you and you what? Give me some more, the dead that's a tea pampa and it's raw. To start with the Ghana, you win the raw, defend this or seco for any football. Me what did you see? Me pim support, Miss Naminaso, take tall, no pin documentary, you be a floor, grab your grab, and your draw, and see your rabba, put on, put off, Miss Abiba, try hardcore, H, 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 H,
Mr. Oduri of Ghana with Abiba, an award-winning film written and directed by an Ethiopian, tells the story of a young Ethiopian girl caught up in her rural village's tradition of abducting girls for marriage. The story is true and helped to make illegal the kidnapping of young girls for marriage, one of Ethiopia's oldest and most deeply rooted traditions. VOA's Kim Lewis reports.
እዛ ገጠር ፖሊስ ጣቢያ አንድ ህፃን ይዘዋል። ኃላፊዋን ገላለች ነው የሚሉት።
አታስቢ፣ በቅርቡ ሚስቴ ትሆኛለች።
እንዳጠጋኝ ጠበቆች ነን። እሺ፣ እኛ ፖሊሶች አይደለን።
ሰው ገላለች፣ ለእሱም በህይወቷ ትከፍላለች።
እሱን የምትወስነው አንተ አይደለ።
Defret means courage in Amharic. It's the title of an award-winning Ethiopian film inspired by the true story of Aberesh Bekele, a 14-year-old girl who in 1996 was abducted on her way home from her village school. The kidnapping of women for marriage was common in the country. However, Aberesh fought back, and in her attempt to escape, she killed her would-be husband. She was charged with murder and stood trial for 2 years. With the help of a tough and passionate lawyer, Meze Ashinafi, Aberesh became the first woman in Ethiopia to be acquitted of murder based on self-defense. Zeresine Berhane Mahari is the writer and director of the film. He describes what motivated him to write the movie, Defret.
I left Ethiopia in 1996 in May, and this particular story happened a couple of months after that. And I returned 8 years later, and I had a chance to meet the lawyer who defended Aberesh, the young girl. Just in a conversation, it came up and what she does, and I wasn't aware about her organization, Ethiopian Women's Lawyers Association. It was first of its kind. It's a non-profit NGO that gives free legal service to women and children. So I just couldn't put it away. The things that she had to go through to get this organization going, and one of the big profile cases that she handled was this abduction case that happened. So I knew that I wanted to make a film about it.
Zeresine says the story of Aberesh is not unique. In his research, he discovered that thousands of young girls are abducted for marriage in Ethiopia and in other countries around the world.
In Aberesh's case, what was different about it is this girl said no to such violence. She had planned to go to school and the parents did not want to marry her off. I also discovered that this is not just particularly an Ethiopian problem. I actually discovered that many places in Asia, in Africa, and in Latin America, and some parts in the Eastern Balkan areas and in Europe, this practice is still alive.
Zeresine said it took a long time to bring Aberesh's story to the big screen. He wrote the screenplay in 2008 and began shopping the script around in Hollywood, California. However, Hollywood had different ideas on how to cast the film.
We had some really interesting offers from producers in Hollywood who wanted to make the film first in English, and then they wanted to cast some famous actors to play the lawyer especially, and they wanted to shoot it outside of Ethiopia, which I was not comfortable with. I knew I wanted to make this film in Amharic, which is the national language of Ethiopia, and I wanted to cast Ethiopian actors, and I wanted to shoot it in Ethiopia, so that did not go through.
After the project was finished, it was shown to Hollywood actress and director Angelina Jolie. She embraced the story and became the movie's executive producer. Jolie has an adopted daughter from Ethiopia, and Zeresine said Jolie's thinking was that Aberesh could have been her daughter. He says the film is also a story of hope.
Basically, having to mobilize the entire country into defending this girl, and basically, women had to stand up to old traditions, and they can fight it in the court of law, they can fight it in the mass media, they can fight it in the opinion polls. And this was something that, for the first time, families in Ethiopia had to sit down and talk about.
Defret has been released across Europe and Asia and will open in the U.S. in New York City on October 23rd. It will then be shown in other U.S. markets and in Canada. Zeresine says because child abductions are prevalent throughout the world, it is his goal that others with similar stories get to have a voice by seeing their own story on film. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
After Egypt freed imprisoned Al Jazeera journalists and others late last month, President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi said his country now enjoys unprecedented freedom of expression. But activists say some journalists remain locked up. One jail journalist is Mohamed Abu Zayed, also known as Shakan, a photographer who has been jailed for more than 2 years. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Cairo.
After some journalists were released in late September, many others in Egypt were relieved, hoping their jobs would soon become safer. But for the family of Mahmoud Abu Zayed, or Shakan, a photographer who documented recent historical events in Egypt for several media houses, including Time magazine and Demotics, it was a major disappointment.
When I didn't see Shah Khan's name among them, I was deeply saddened. I was so sad I could not believe it. It was difficult for me to accept the news.
Shah Khan was arrested in August 2013, but just last month, his trial date was finally set for December. While he waits, his family says his health is rapidly deteriorating.
His face is paler every time we visit. His sight is failing, and he can't sleep from depression and sadness. These and many other factors have led to his failing physical and psychological health.
Shakan was arrested in a sweep of protesters and journalists after covering the Rabaa protest camp. The protest was in support of ousted Muslim Brotherhood president Mohamed Morsi, who is now in jail sentenced to death. It lasted more than a month and ended in clashes where hundreds were killed. Most detained at the time have since been released, but his brother says Shakan is accused of several crimes, including murder. Shokhan claims no political affiliations, but among some Egyptians, anti-Muslim Brotherhood sentiment is so high that even covering the now banned group is considered suspect.
For those journalists, God knows if they sold their conscience or made a deal with the Muslim Brotherhood. And as you know very well, the Brotherhood can brainwash people.
Egyptian journalists don't generally contest the government's assertion that the Muslim Brotherhood is a terrorist organization. But they say covering the organization does not make one a member. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehia Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Pete Hundley, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
An international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States is determined to disrupt the illicit flow of money from the trade of oil and trafficking of antiquities to the terrorist group Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. Toward this end, the U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the significant disruption of the sale and/or trade of oil and antiquities by, for, on behalf of, or to benefit ISIL. Through its illegal oil operations and trafficking in looted archaeological material from Syria and Iraq, ISIL has generated millions of dollars in hard currency, enabling it to brutalize and oppress innocent civilians. This is the first time the U.S. Secretary of State has authorized a Rewards for Justice offer for information that could be used to disrupt the sale or trade in oil and antiquities by or on behalf of a terrorist organization. Anyone with information on oil and antiquities trafficking that benefits ISIL can contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net or by standard mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. Individuals in North America can also call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927. All information will be kept strictly confidential. The Rewards for Justice program is administered by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Since its inception in 1984, the program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that put terrorists behind bars or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. Follow us on Twitter at https://twitter.com/rewardsforjustice, as in the numeral 4.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello. I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.